So to return to the Kahau, how is that program progressing?
Well, for the next 14 years, the Kahau conservation program settled into an annual routine. And by agonizingly slow degrees, I saw the population begin to turn around from what had been a slow decline, arrested in the nick of time, to a gradually accelerating increase. So just as everything was looking rosy, a new crisis developed. And the awful thing about this one is that there was absolutely nothing that I could do about it hands-on. And this was the crisis of DDT use and the decline of birds that was finally associated with the broad-scale use of DDT in aerial spray programs like the spruce budworm spraying up in Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, or salt marsh mosquito spraying all down the east coast of North America. It was first evident with the decline of raptorial birds like peregrines and ospreys, and it took many years to figure out the link with DDT. But what was eventually discovered is that the breakdown product of DDT, called DDE, was a very long residual contaminant in the environment, which was absorbed in the fat of fish-eating birds in particular, or predatory birds in particular, where there was a longer food chain. And while it was not a high enough concentration to actually poison the adult birds themselves, it was enough to cause a problem with their reproduction, in that the eggs had thinner shells, and so the eggs would fail in the nest before they could hatch. And so it was as good as killing the adults if they could no longer breed successfully. And the Kahau was the first bird which was not actually living in an area where DDT was being used. That was used locally in a minor way, but not enough to affect, you know, the whole ocean around Bermuda. It was these big aerial spray programs on the continent. It would blow down in the weather systems over the Atlantic. And we were the first to prove that even a bird like a seabird remote from the sources of aerial sprays was being affected. And I worked in co-authorship with one of the primary researchers on the effect of DDT on birds, Dr. Charlie Worster, and we got a paper published in Science magazine. And I was, when the great DDT hearings in Congress were held in order for Congress to decide whether to ban DDT or not, I was invited up I can't remember the town it was in Pennsylvania, but I know that we stayed at the Hort Mountain Sanctuary, and then we drove to the hearings from there. And it was wonderful to experience American democracy in action. And so I made my small contribution by telling the story of DDT contamination in the Kahaus. But back at home, it was reducing the breeding success, which was already low enough, even further. And it went from about a little over 50, maybe 60% of the eggs would hatch, down to about 35% of the eggs hatching. And so we were starting to lose ground again, and there was nothing that I could personally do about it, you know. But with the baffler, it was a hands-on thing, and we could find all the nests and install the bafflers. But with the DDT, this was a global problem, and it could only be solved globally by everyone. So
what did happen? How did you increase the breeding again?
Well, happily, American democracy worked, and DDT was finally banned on the American continent, and of course in Europe at the same time, Great Britain and most of the European countries, although they were still selling it, of course, to the third world countries, which is an obscene fact of life. But they were far enough away that the effect on the ocean downwind from America was finally resolved. And so agonizingly, slowly again, the breeding success began to come up. And really only at that point, which by this time was, 20 years after the rediscovery, did I begin to see a real increase in the number of chicks being hatched. But it started then, and then it began to get more and more exponential. And of course, the exciting thing about exponential is that with each doubling, you were producing twice as many chicks as before. And but it wasn't until the 1980s that this really happened. And meanwhile, my life was overtaken by a second tragedy.
Okay, so we'll stop. What was that tragedy, David?
It was the loss of my first wife. Am I still? I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I still weep about this.
It's ready now.
That tragedy was the sudden, unexpected loss of my first wife, Anita. And it happened on a hot summer day when she was wearing a bikini and went out with the garbage to burn in an incinerator that we kept on the island for this purpose, because you couldn't take your garbage ashore, so you had to sort of try and deal with it on the island. And of course, we were in the habit of using Coleman lanterns for light at night still. We didn't have electricity there yet, except by generator, which was noisy, and we didn't like to run it all night. And you use methylated spirits to squirt into a little bulb to preheat the Coleman lanterns to get them working. And so we didn't have any sense that methylated spirits was a hazardous thing to use. And so it had rained the night before, and Anita didn't realize that the fire from the previous day was still smoldering underneath the damp garbage on top. And so she squirted the methylated spirit on to match to try and light it. And of course, the summer heat combined with the heat of the garbage still burning underneath created an explosive gas mixture, and it exploded. And she was burned over 70% of her body, not her face, happily, but because she was wearing a bikini. And she had the sense to dash over to the clothesline where some damp sheets had just been hung up and wrapped herself in those and shouted to our neighbours on the island, because by this time the little cottage on the island, the caretaker's cottage, was rented in the summer to other members of the Department of Agriculture staff to take their families out. And that was always helpful to have the families on the island. And it was Dewey Marcotte was the name of the husband of that family, who realized what had happened and quickly called he had to take her ashore. They couldn't call. Or did we have a phone? I think we had a phone on the island at that time. And so he called the ambulance to come, and he took her ashore to Tuckerstown. Meanwhile, I was at my office in the conservation department, which was right adjacent to the hospital. And so when I got the word that she had been just taken into the hospital, I was just able to walk across the street to the hospital. And it might have been all right. We were scheduled to go on summer holiday, because when the cahows finally all left, you had that free period of the summer between July and October, free of the cow house, to get on with your life. And so we had planned to take the children, who by now were sub-teens, up to Maine to a summer camp where I had gone before I even went to Cornell, and enjoy you know, a summer with the children up in the Canadian or the Maine wilderness. And the doctor said, well, she might still be all right, you know, to do that, because they're just flash burns and they're not deep burns on her skin. But unfortunately, they didn't have anyone at the hospital who really understood the treatment of burns at that time. And she was somewhat neglected by the nurses who weren't checking. So when I went to check on her frequently, I would find the IV drip in her veins would have fallen out on the floor, and she was too out of it with pain to realize that it happened. And I would have to rush in and say, nurse, nurse, you know, she's lost her IV drip. You better get this installed. At any rate, over the next 3 or 4 days, I visited her as often as I could, and but also had to look after the children on the island, or, you know, at least make sure they were okay with the help of the other family on the island. But by the fourth day, I suddenly realized that her eyes were hollow and sunken, and she was barely conscious. And I rushed out, and the IV drip was lying on the floor again. So I rushed out and I said, nurse, you've got to do something about this girl. She's dying in there. And so all bedlam went loose at that point. And it was a weekend, and typically, you know, Sunday, and the doctors were out on the golf course. And by the time they got there, she had died.
And did that straight.
I mean, I was in utter shock.
Were you there when she died?
It was early August, and I think it was the 4th of August. Every year on that date, it's like a very depressing period for about a week that I have to go through.
Of course.
And, you know, I had two children, sub-teen, both girls, and it was very, very difficult to deal with, and she had been such a wonderful mother. So, you know, essentially my life went a bit haywire after that, and the end result of that was that I married again far too soon, when I was still in love with Anita, but of course Elizabeth, who I married, was a very good housekeeper for the children and took over a lot of that responsibility. And in fact, she moved into the same routine of living on non-search in the summer with the children and us, and living ashore in the winter. By this time, I had inherited a house on the mainland, so that we had our own winter home rather than a rental. And but it was, you know, it was not a love match, and I lasted it out until the children were old enough to really understand before I decided to get the divorce. And of course I hated to have to do it, but meanwhile I really threw all of my energy into the non-search project, and there was a lot of work to be done out there with the botanical replanting of the island. I planted over 6,000 trees and shrubs. I undertook a study of the long tails, where I had about 200 nests under observation. So I was just busy, 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 keeping distracted. And that routine went right on through the 80s, alongside the Cahao routine, but which by this time was finally beginning to turn around in a serious way, with more and more chicks being hatched each year and more fledgling. So that was what buoyed me up. Just being able to stay on Nonsuch, you know, living on Nonsuch in the summer months, kept me sane, really. Yeah.
Is it true, David, that Kahau's mate for life?
Yes, it is, and that actually raises a very good point, because by this time in my career, I have begun to realize how incredibly similar the married life of the Kahau's is to the human married life. And the reason it's so similar is because in both cases, the children depend on both parents for a good upbringing. And in the case of the cows, if one of the parents dies, the other one cannot possibly rear that chick to fledgling. And so in the process of evolution, natural selection deals with this by evolving a very strong pair bond. And to watch a pair of cows courting in the snug security of their burrow, which by this time I was able to do quite comfortably, because the three things about the Kahau program that had to be done was, first of all, protecting them from rats, and then protecting them from long tails with the baffler, and finally solving the problem of where to accommodate the additional chicks that were being born, because these islands were so small, they're only 3 acres, and every single deep crevice on them was already occupied by Kahau's at this time, and so they had nowhere else to go, and they weren't going to go to another island, because there is another phenomenon, which is the, I can't think of the term now, but where the pairs are stimulated by each other's presence in the area, and this gives them the confidence to settle in a pre-existing colony. But if there is an adjacent island with no cows on it, they instinctively know to avoid it, because there's usually a good reason, which would be mammal predators or some other factor. So the pair bond was one factor, and the need for company was another. And this posed a big challenge to me with Nonsuch, because the whole idea of the Nonsuch restoration was to create a home for the Kahau's as their population began to increase. And they weren't colonizing the island. So what I had to do instead was to provide the burrows for them. And this was, I guess, in addition to the baffler, my most significant contribution to the Kahau program. This was my own personal contribution to the Kahau program, and that was the artificial burrow to save them the trouble of having to find a site and then excavate a burrow, which was impossible on these islands anyway, because the soil was all eroded due to the proximity to the sea. And so they had no place to burrow. And building artificial burrows was the way to solve this. And I learned that if I built these burrows as close adjacent to the occupied burrows as possible, then it was far more likely that they would be colonized quickly. Because the first thing the chicks do is, when they're old enough to be, they come back to the home burrow. And the parents, which are very long-lived, are still occupying it. So they're, sorry, buddy, you're going to have to find your own home, which was kind of like what my parents told me, you know, when I came back from Cornell. And so I have this lovely image in my mind of the Kahau's all snug and secure in their burrows, and me living on Nonsuch snug and secure with my family. And, you know, these two parallel worlds, which are so completely opposite in reality. With the Kahau's world is the open ocean, which is a great dread for us. And you know, when they would strike off out into the middle of a winter gale and disappear on the ocean, you couldn't help thinking, how different when we need the snug security of a house on terra firma and a nice fireplace to snuggle up against, you know, yeah.
So David, was your work with the Kahau, extensive as it had been, was it recognised by this time?
Well, no, as a matter of fact, it was such a slow and agonising process bringing the Kahau back that there really wasn't much to say about it, you know, or to publish about it at that point. I think the first paper I published on the Kahau wasn't until the late 80s or the 90s. So I always had that sort of anxiety feeling in the background that I needed to prove myself ornithologically to the ornithological world. And I wanted to do so if only to prove to the people like Richard Poe, who had thought that I ought to go on, you know, to get a master's and a doctorate, that I was worthy of it. And I saw my opportunity in the case of the black cat petrel of the West Indies, which of course is a very similar seabird in the same genus as the Kahau, and it had an almost identical history of human exploitation following colonization of the New World and supposed extinction. But in this case, the extinction wasn't 300 years ago, it was about a century before. And I rationalized that, God, if the Kahau could survive on 3 acres of rocky islands on urban Bermuda, surely there was a chance that they were still surviving on such wilderness islands as Dominica in the Lesser Antilles or Hispaniola, which houses the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And so I decided that I now knew a better way of going about searching, and I realized that the reason that nobody before me had been able to rediscover the black cat petrels, assuming they even survived at all, was because they were going about it wrong. And any number of top echelon ornithologists had tried this. There was Alexander Wetmore. Dr. Murphy himself didn't go down, but he sent his his top field man, Rollo Beck, and then the famous James Bond, who published the field guide to to the birds of the West Indies, who was the person from whom James Bond movies were made. He had searched all of these islands too, and they had all failed. And I thought, I think I've got a way of going about looking for them that might succeed if they still exist at all. And so I decided to launch an expedition in 1963, which was quite soon after I graduated, just at the beginning of my work with the Kahau. And I rationalized that the way to go about looking for them wasn't to do daytime searches for burrows in the high mountains, but to listen for them at night from likely areas of steep mountain cliff where there was less likelihood that the humans or the mammal predators could get at them. And so I arranged this expedition with Haiti. There was an Englishman in Bermuda at the time who was an architect, but he and I were close friends, and we decided to get together for this expedition because I didn't want to be single, you know, on this. And we practiced by, because the first island I went to, wanted to go to, was Dominica in the Lesser Antilles, because that the last petrel there had been seen in 1932. It was a specimen picked up in the streets of Roseau, which implied that they were nesting up in the mountains. And Dominica is a very, very wild mountainous island. I think the average slope in Dominica was about 70 degrees. And then the other place was Haiti, where Alexander Wetmore had received so many reports of of, you know, these nocturnal birds. And so the expedition was planned to go to Dominica first and then on to Haiti. And my friend, Graham Mingus Kitchen was his name, and I practiced on Bermuda with 60-pound backpacks, because we'd have to climb up into these mountains for several days at a time and have enough food and so forth, and flashlights and all the other equipment. And there's a cliff called Abbott's Cliff in the north side of Harrington Sound, which is the highest and steepest cliff in Bermuda, with about a 70-degree slope. And so we would scramble up and down Abbott's Cliff 8 or 10 times to get fit for this expedition. And he was able to join me in Dominica, but we soon realized, or at least I soon realized, that the forest is so dense and the noise of insects and other creatures was so loud that even if the birds were nesting, I would not be able to hear them. And we would cut windows onto the edge of these sheer escarpments that would overlook valleys like the Picard River, and have our tent right there, and then listen at night where you had this vast valley in front of you. And we could never see anything or detect any sound.
So you decided to go to Haiti then?
So then I decided to go on to Haiti, but he couldn't follow. He had to get back to his job in Bermuda. And so I went on to Haiti alone, and that was pretty scary, because even then Haiti was a very crowded island. And when I got to the airport, as soon as I got out of customs, you were absolutely mobbed by desperate people wanting, you know, to be your guide, basically, like they did with all the other tourists. But I wasn't the tourist. But I quickly saw that the way around this was to accept one of them as your guide. And then he immediately chased all the others away. In other words, he had the ability to put everyone else off. And so this gentleman was a taxi driver. William Bishop was his name. And I set up at the Park Hotel, which was right opposite Papadoc's Palace, because Papadoc was in power at that time. And I explained to William Bishop what I was there to try and do. And so I drew a picture of the black cat petrel and said, "I'm looking for this bird." And he was amazing. He said, "Ah," he says, I know of at least 7 different places in Port-au-Prince where there are bird collections, you know, and they range from a convent to a brothel down on the shore, which the US Navy used to take the benefit of. And so he took me to all of these places, and blow me if in every case we found a specimen of black cat petrel. And the dates on the specimen were all within the previous 10 years. And so this proved to me that the petrels were still nesting on Haiti, somewhere up in the mountains, and where we were. And the reason they were coming down and being found on the streets of Roseau was also obvious to me by this time, is that these seabirds are confused and attracted to bright lights at night. And so fledglings taking off from their burrows in the mountains were probably getting confused by the lights of Roseau, crashing into buildings and falling underground. That's how they were found. So I knew that some mountain area close to Port-au-Prince would be the place to search for them. And so William Bishop then took me up to the top of the nearest mountain chain, right above the city, where you could look across to La Selle Ridge, which is a huge escarpment that runs from Mont-la-Visite in the west all the way down to Pic La Selle near the Dominican Republic border. And it's about, I think, 7 or 10 miles of this steep escarpment, which is a 3,000-foot cliff. So that was the next step of my expedition. And But there were no roads into Lasdale Ridge, and so I had to put on my backpack and walk in over these steep intervening mountains, past all these very poor peasants living in grass-thatched huts, and got into areas where they had never seen a white man, apparently. So really wilderness. And on the very first overnight camp on this steep escarpment at Mont-la-Visite at the west end of the escarpment, the anticipation of dusk, you know, and waiting for darkness to see whether I would hear the birds, at least I had a good view because it was pine forest, it was fairly open, and it was fairly silent up there. The sound carried wonderfully. You could hear the voodoo drums down in the valleys echoing up. And about half an hour after dark, I heard it. And I knew what to expect because all of these petrels have very similar calls. And this call was as close to identical to the cahow as you could get. And first there was one, then there was two, and eventually there were dozens of them.
You had rediscovered the black cap petrel. Can you mimic its call, or can you exemplify it? I believe the name of the cahow is taken from its call. Is that true?
Yeah, exactly. It's an onomatopoeic word. If my mouth isn't too dry, I can sometimes do it. The cahow in Bermuda goes that. That's the male, and the female, ironically, is harsher and more coarse. It's more like oh-eek, oh-eek. And the black-capped petrel is almost identical. So I knew exactly what to hear. And so over the next 2 weeks that I was in Haiti, I think it was another 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I went all the way down this ridge, cutting night watch points at intervals along the ridge through the dense thickets and listening. And at every stop, I found another colony. And so by the time I got to Pic Lastel, I realized that there were thousands of these birds surviving. And here, no one had detected them except, of course, the Haitian peasants who lived in the area, who not only knew about them, they went by a totally different name. Chatouant was one of the names, which means, I'm not sure what it means in...
It means black cat.
That's right. It's a black cat. And so...
So you were suddenly famous.
So, and it was the following summer that I was able to go to an ornithological conference in Florida and give my paper, which was ultimately published in the ORC. Yes, I suppose it made me famous because I had beaten people like Alexander Wetmore, Murphy, and James Bond to be the rediscoverer of the black-capped petrel.